Buenos dias, world, from the San Diego Zoo Wildlife Alliance. I'm Marco Wendt.
And I'm Rick Schwartz. And we're your hosts for Season 3 of Amazing Wildlife, a show from iHeartRadio Ruby Studio and the global conservation organization behind the San Diego Zoo and the San Diego Zoo Safari Park.
Listen as we dive into the efforts here in San Diego and spotlight the heroes working worldwide to care for the species you know and love.
Listen to Amazing Wildlife on the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts.
If you've ever dreamed of writing a book someday, you're not alone. Close to a million manuscripts are submitted annually to publishers, editors, and agents. And of those, about 100,000 new titles are published every year. Some books flop and grow dust on bookstore shelves and end up in the bargain bin. And some become bestsellers, which is every publisher's and author's dream. But just what does it take to get a book from the author's mind into the reader's hands? And how does it become a success?
As an editor, it feels like everybody that you talk to is writing a book or wants to write a book or thinks they could write a book. So those people are curious from the perspective of a potential author about how their book might find its way into print and into the hands of readers. But I've already found, just from talking to many, many authors about this, and this is, a problem for publishers. It's something they don't do as well as they should. Publishing is sort of a black box to authors. Even people who have been published don't really understand what happens once they hand their work over to the editor or to their agent. And I hope that this will explain to people who are being published by traditional publishers or people who are starting to think about publishing themselves or people who are beginning to think about, I want to be an author, or as you say, an English major who's got an idea of, I'd like to write something. Here's how the sausage is made.
That's Peter Ganay, editor and author of the new book, What Editors Do, The Art, Craft, and Business of Book Editing. He says that if you were able to peek into the windows of a major publishing house, one thing you wouldn't see would be editors poring over manuscripts with a pencil.
That work tends to get done when they get home at night or on their weekends, or maybe they sort of take out their iPad and read something on the bus on the way home. But you'd see people in a marketing meeting talking about how we're going to get attention for this first novel, an editorial assistant sorting through a pile of photographs, trying to figure out which ones are going to go in the photo insert of a book, or calling up people and trying to get permission to use those photographs. You'd almost certainly somewhere in a publishing house see an editor buttonholing a colleague in the hallway and saying, I just got this wonderful manuscript we've been waiting for a year, and the author just delivered, and it's everything we expected, and you got to read it tonight.
Ganay says book editing is one of the few careers that is still learned through apprenticeship.
When you start out in the business, you usually begin as an editorial assistant, kind of the bottom of the totem pole, and you learn about editing from working with editors. There's almost no publishing house that has a training program for people who are starting out. There are some universities and colleges that have courses in publishing, and that's been a bit of a growing phenomenon. But most people who get into publishing have to kind of learn it on the job.
If you've ever read author acknowledgments, you'll know the author almost always thanks his or her editor, often saying something like, this book wouldn't be half as good without so-and-so's help. But how much help? How many words on the page come from the author, and how many from the editor?
The philosophy of book editing, which is different often from editing in newspapers or magazines, for example, is really that the book belongs to the author. And even when you're sort of deeply involved in something as an editor, and authors are usually very generous about crediting what their editors have done, it's always your goal to make the book the best version of the author's conception of it that it can be, not to impose your taste or your ideas on the author. So even if you're editing a book, you know, and marking up every paragraph in some way, which is not at all uncommon, you still are doing it in the service of the author's idea, the author's expression.
Even authors of great classics written by the likes of Faulkner, Hemingway, and Woolf had editors.
There was actually a movie called Genius that came out about F. Scott Fitzgerald, Thomas Wolfe and their editor, one of the great editors of all time, Maxwell Perkins, who worked at Scribner's. Perkins kind of famously literally took a manuscript that was about the size of a refrigerator from Thomas Wolfe and shaped it into a best-selling and classic book. But not every author needs that heavy an edit.
That being said, editing the manuscript is not the only thing a book editor does.
The first thing that editors have to do, and in some ways even more important, is find books to publish and determine which books are going to get published and see those books kind of into the marketplace. You have to think about the market when you're acquiring something. I've talked about this in certain forums, and authors kind of tend to jump on me and say, every book is an artistic thing and it's not about commerce and so on. But the fact is that your job as a publisher is to put the author's wonderful, unique, artistic book in the hands of readers. If you're going to publish something effectively, when you acquire it, you have to think about who's the potential reader for this. It's not enough really to say, I love this book and it's wonderful and it's a unique voice or whatever. That's the first thing. That's the first threshold you want the book to get over. But then the next thing is, who is going to respond to this?
One thing is clear, however. The editor has to love the book, not just think it could sell.
You're asking your colleagues, what do you think about this? And somebody from marketing says, oh, we can really sell a lot of these. The books that you acquire that way, sort of cynically or with an eye to the market rather than to your own enthusiasm, are always the ones that are the worst publishing experiences, because it's just, you have to invest so much of your own time and energy in any publication as an editor, and that's true for other people along the publishing chain, that if you don't love the book, it just becomes a drudgery. And the flip side of that is, when you really are excited about something, it's easy. I mean, it's never easy because there's so much work that goes involved, that goes into publishing anything. But we've all had the feeling of, we read this book, it was so great, we can't wait to tell somebody else about it. We know just the person who is a friend of ours who's going to love this book. You want to tell them about it. And that's really kind of what editors do, just on a larger scale.
Ganesh says literary agents are a vital component of the publishing industry.
The agents are the people who filter out the giant tsunami of manuscripts before the publishers have to do the filtering. I mean, they're the pre-filter. The first role of a good agent is, as an editor, when an agent sends you something, you know that they've screened out 100 other things to send you this one book proposal or manuscript. And by the way, you're going to turn down things from 99 agents to acquire one book that you're excited about. I'm maybe exaggerating the numbers there, but probably not all that much.
Which is why so many authors these days decide to self-publish.
The number of books that are being published has exponentially grown in the last several years, thanks to particularly ebooks and also Amazon and other online sellers that have made it so much easier to publish your own works. There's a huge explosion in self-publishing. The increasing technological things that made self-publishing so easy for a while led to arguments that publishers are going to be extinct. Who needs Random House or Scribner's when you can just put the book out there yourself with a few clicks? But one of the downsides to it from the author's point of view and from the commercial publisher's point of view is it just floods titles onto the market. So it makes the problem of finding something good to read all the more challenging for a reader.
Ganesh says editors provide a valuable service to readers when there's so much competition out there.
The marketplace is so crowded. There are so many books competing for people's attention. I mean, you know that there's hundreds, literally hundreds of thousands of titles are published every year. How do you get one book to stand out? The selection part that editors do of plucking something out of the stream of titles and manuscripts and saying, this book is really worth your attention, here's why. That's a more valuable function than ever for readers and for sort of culture in general. The average consumer has got Angry Birds and Twitter and the news at the end of their fingertips on their phone. You've got to really present something that's worth taking them away from Candy Crush to make it successful.
At the end of the day, there's nothing quite like a terrific book that pulls you in and keeps you hooked until the very last page. Without critical editors working alongside authors pushing the script along, these great reads would be few and far between. Who knows? With a creative idea, a smart editor, and some luck, maybe your manuscript will become the next New York Times bestseller. You can learn more about the vital role editors play in Peter Ganay's book, What Editors Do: The Art, Craft, and Business of Book Editing. For more information about all of our guests and past archives of programs, log on to our site at viewpointsradio.org. To see more behind the scenes, search Viewpoints Radio on Twitter and Facebook. This segment was written by Polly Henson and originally aired in April 2019. Our executive producer is Amira Zaveri. I'm Gary Price.
Cardiovascular or CV disease is the number one killer of adults in the U.S., and millions of people trying to reduce their risk of a heart attack or stroke may unknowingly be taking medications that are not proven nor FDA approved to reduce cardiovascular risk. Let's hear from cardiologist Dr. John Osborne.
Many people are unaware that after a failed outcome study, the FDA revoked the approval of fenofibrates when added to statins, as the risk outweighed the benefits to heart health. It's important to remember that statins, along with diet and exercise, can lower cardiovascular risk by about 25 to 35%. But persistent cardiovascular risk, which can lead to a life-threatening event, may remain. I would tell anyone still being prescribed fenofibrates, such as Tricor and Trilipix, with a statin, to talk to their doctor about FDA-approved therapies for cardiovascular risk reduction.
To learn more and get clear on the facts, visit itscleartomenow.com. Again, that's itscleartomenow.com.
And that's Viewpoints for this week. Viewpoints is a production of MediaTracks Communications. Follow us on Twitter, Facebook, and Instagram to learn more about upcoming shows and find a library of past programs on Apple Podcasts, Google Play, and Spotify. Plus, you'll always find previous segments and more information about our guests at viewpointsradio.org. Join us again next week for another edition of Viewpoints.
Coming up on Viewpoints.
When this began, of course, there were no N95 masks. People also couldn't source elastic, so people were making masks.
How one man's disposable mask can be a historian's treasure. Then,
the people that wear these pieces are key to their iconic status, because I guess it's an icon on an icon.
Why do some pieces stay fashionable for generations? I'm Marty Peterson.
And I'm Gary Price. These stories in depth on your public affairs magazine, Viewpoints.
Buenos dias, world, from the San Diego Zoo Wildlife Alliance. I'm Marco Wendt.
And I'm Rick Schwartz.
And we're your hosts for Season 3 of Amazing Wildlife, a show from iHeartRadio Ruby Studio and the global conservation organization behind the San Diego Zoo and the San Diego Zoo Safari Park.
Listen as we dive into the efforts here in San Diego and spotlight the heroes working worldwide to care for the species you know and love.
Listen to Amazing Wildlife on the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts.